voiceover. Human voice. There's nothing like it for strength and impact. It's the most direct means of communication. It's the only instrument you can't see and can't touch. It's not like anything else. And whatever else opera is about, it's certainly about the human voice. More specifically, it's the voice fully extended over the orchestra that's one of the particular excitements of opera. Vendetta duet from Verdi's Rigoletto, sung there by Cheryl Milnes and Joan Sutherland. How far do we take in what singers are really doing? A record like that, with singers of that caliber, can be exciting. And so, of course, can opera on television. But it's in the opera house itself that you get the full impact. And what the singers are doing is nothing less than miraculous, at least according to Lord Harwood, whose great passion has always been singers and singing, and who's now managing director of English National Opera.
The miracle they're achieving, of course, is by their own well-regulated lung power, beautifully subduing an orchestra of 80 or 100. Now, that is impossible, but it's regularly done night after night in opera houses by people who are proficient at it. And in itself, that's mildly thrilling. In itself, it's a built-in plus. Now, on a record, they must be heard, because if they're not, they'll have another take. That's kind of axiomatic. And you don't get that element of the thrill of the great voice coming over beautifully, easily, subduing an 80-piece or 100-piece orchestra. You can't get that on television. You do constantly get it in an opera house.
The superb, the arrogant, the almost unnatural eloquence of the human voice at full stretch. Subduing the orchestra, as Lord Harwood puts it. Now, why unnatural eloquence? Well, very often in life, when we pass a certain point, words tend to fail us, literally. Some of us find it difficult to express ourselves. We can only splutter and stutter. We're literally speechless with emotion. And this is where opera can take over. If you're really seething with anger, wouldn't it be marvellous to be able to express it like Cheryl Milnes did a moment ago in that excerpt from Rigoletto? Opera can and does express those moments of anger and jealousy and terror and longing and ecstasy, passions of all kinds when words threaten to fail us. The voice of Birgit Nilsson, a miracle if ever there was one, triumphing as Isolde in the operatic Battleground. Now, Battleground is a word Laurie Taylor used a while ago when opera came up for discussion in the BBC radio programme Stop the Week. The singer often has many elements to fight, as it were. Not just the orchestra, but scenery, costumes, chorus.
All that artifice, all that sweetness, all those sort of gattos, all the florid nudge, you know, the fact that it is too much, suddenly provides the base upon which you hear the human voice, like rising above all that. It's as though almost the battleground of the scenery and, I mean, I don't know whether elephants or not, but I mean, you know, that the whole, the enormity compared to all those other theatre productions that you see, the great technicolour, big stage, cinemascopic nature of it, and then to hear a single person standing in the middle with that voice is magnificent.
Finale of Act One of Verdi's A Masked Ball, with the voice of Placido Domingo, among others, rising above it all. There is something magnificent about these great concerted numbers in opera. It's as though the composer has been rushing headlong to a bottleneck, and his vast forces, a full orchestra and massed chorus as well as soloists, have to thrust themselves through it in what sounds like a frenzied, though actually it's meticulously organized, competition. And to top it, the single voice rising above it all. It isn't only in opera that you get good voices. You get them in musicals, too. Big voices, Ethel Merman, beautifully focused voices like Julie Andrews. But even if you can have the voices in musicals, you still don't get this voice-over thrill that you can get in the opera house. Even when the voices are capable of rising above it all, there simply isn't as much to rise above. We asked music critic Alan Blythe, our consultant on these programs, if he could tell us what he thought were the principal differences between the two forms, opera and musical.
Two things. One, the microphone. Two, the orchestration are the main things. I think when you get an orchestra which is not basically what we know as a conventional symphonic orchestra, then I would say that people are beginning to think that it isn't opera. They may be right or they may be wrong, but I would say that was one division. And the second division, in the musical theatre, you get the singers using microphones, and you don't get that in opera.
Alan Blythe, a smaller orchestra and often a less dense orchestral texture, and the microphone, of course, which is an aid the opera singer certainly doesn't have. Opera needs to be projected against obstacles, seemingly against the odds, with an often ferocious energy. And the sheer scale of it all can be overwhelming, even for those accustomed to it. Jenny Bardwell is an experienced theatre goer who came to opera much later. And the sheer size, what Laurie Taylor called the cinemascopic nature of it, was a revelation to her.
Everything is magnified. I think that's what's so exciting about it. It's so much larger than life. And especially in the theatre these days, the emphasis is on naturalism and underplaying and understatement. And then in the opera, the singers really let rip, and it's, you know, huge expansive gestures and loud, loud voices. I think that's what's particularly exciting.
So it's magnificent, it's magnified. To some, maybe too much so. Certainly, as Jenny was saying, it's a long way from the kind of modern spoken drama we've become used to, especially on television, the kind of drama which tries to reproduce the impression of everyday reality, hair nets and all. The outsized nature of opera, for many people, is a part of its appeal, while others find it simply too extravagant, too outlandish. Mind you, people have always enjoyed a certain amount of extravagance. For much of the 19th century, there wasn't this gulf between opera and spoken theatre, and audiences going from one to another didn't have to make so great an adjustment. The theatre of those days was often romantic and unashamedly melodramatic. There were plots thick with scheming marquises and villainous landlords and heroines with questionable bundles being turned out into the snow. But people enjoy extravagance, even today. Car chases and shootouts are part of what we go to the cinema for. No one raises an eyebrow at disaster movies, and we take mythological fights in our stride, Star Wars and the like. And what about all those romantic love stories? Romance has never gone out of fashion. Look at Dallas on television, and costume drama, which keeps the nation switched on for weeks at a time. If spills and thrills and romance appeal to you, you could do worse than opera. In fact, you could hardly do better. What with shipwrecks and cities burning, conspiracies, gallows scenes and funeral pyres, masked balls and Elysian fields, and hell's mouth opening unblushingly at your feet. And of course, romance. What would opera be without romance? That could almost be film music, but actually it isn't. It's by Richard Strauss, and it comes from his opera Rosenkavalier. Just the sort of music which has been much imitated by film composers. But it is opera. Listen for a moment to how the excerpt continues. Christa Ludwig and Theresa Stich-Randl in the final duet from Richard Strauss's Rosenkavalier. An example of what you might call the quieter thrill to be found in opera. Voices not singing at full blast, as in the Rigoletto and Tristan excerpts we heard earlier, but floated exquisitely and still reaching the farthest corners of the opera house. In this kind of delicate singing, the voices are particularly vulnerable, more exposed, the flaws more obvious. Here, the two were singing essentially the same music, expressing the same emotions. One of the special advantages opera has over spoken drama is that you can have not just duets, but trios, quartets, quintets, and so on, however many characters you like, expressing different emotions at the same time. You may not be able to catch all the words, but if it's well written, you'll be able to take in what they're feeling with the help of the musical line. First one dominates, and then another. There's a subtly gauged ebb and flow as the voices blend and separate, as in the quartet from the last act of Verdi's Rigoletto. Listen first to the seductive grace and charm of the tenor as he sets out to make a new conquest. Bella figlia dell'amore, schiavo fondere i tuoi, onde donde posso. Other voices join in. There's flirtatious resistance from the contralto, then cries of outrage from the soprano, whom the tenor has previously seduced and abandoned. And finally, to complete the quartet, the baritone father, Rigoletto himself, finding a sort of melancholy gratification in the thought that at least his daughter's eyes will now be open to the true nature of her seducer.
Oh! quartet from Verdi's Rigoletto, with Cheryl Mills and Joan Sutherland, whom you heard at the beginning of the programme, joined there by Luciano Pavarotti and Huguette Tourangeau. In a complex piece like this, there are special problems of balance. Each must be heard, but none must dominate except when the musical and dramatic situation demands it. It's like an instrumental ensemble in a sense, except that here you're dealing with that very special, that specially vulnerable instrument, the human voice. It is a very vulnerable instrument, and in opera, tremendous demands are made on it. Something might suddenly go wrong at any moment. And so it might, too, in a large chorus. But here, there is a difference. At least there's usually no problem getting the voice over. With dozens of voices massed, the vulnerability of the individual voices doesn't matter so much. We heard the chorus a few minutes ago in the masked ball as one of the elements the solo singer had to contend with, and we heard the voice of Placido Domingo coming out thrillingly on top. But here, in a chorus from Mussorgsky's Boris Godunov, listen to a chorus of voices with no soloists, subduing the orchestra. It's been said that it's the Russian people, represented by the chorus, that's the real hero of the opera, rather than Boris himself. Chorus from Mussorgsky's Boris Godunov. Choruses are important in opera, partly because they introduce a different tonal colour, and from a very particular point of view, they offer a telling contrast to the solo voice. A mass of voices together, producing a huge volume of sound, can sometimes persuade you that collectively, at any rate, the human voice can be invincible. There are problems for the chorus, of course, keeping together, keeping in tune, problems of balance, and especially the problem of getting 100 singers to sing precisely together with the orchestra as well as with each other. That's mainly the responsibility of the conductor. We'll be hearing more about that in a later program. But at least with a big chorus, there's some sort of safety in numbers. If one voice fails, it's unlikely that all the others will too. Whereas with the individual singer, something might go suddenly, painfully wrong at any moment, with much more obvious exposure. And that, strange as it may seem, can be part of the enjoyment of opera. It's just the same when you go to the circus and watch someone tightrope walking or on the trapeze. They might fall. How much more exciting when they don't have safety nets. It's not that you're willing them to fall. On the contrary, you're willing them to succeed. But the element of risk is a vital part of it. One of the special thrills of a live performance in an opera house is that every time a singer opens his mouth, the voice may fail. A performance on record may be more perfect, but paradoxically, it may have less impact.
You get an atmosphere in the opera house. There's no substitute for it anywhere, just like going to a theater or going to a concert. There's no substitute for the real thing, even if it's flawed. And perhaps that's part of the excitement that something might go wrong. You'd never know what to expect. But if you put on your gramophone record or your videotape, you know exactly what to expect after the second time. Even the first time, because you know it wouldn't be sold, would it? Unless it were perfect.
Hilda Biel, Covent Garden's German language coach. Robert Lloyd is an outstanding international bass with a number of distinguished recordings to his credit. Nonetheless, he agrees with Hilda that there's nothing like the real thing, and for him too, studio recordings are almost too perfect.
The central excitement of opera is the human voice fully extended over an orchestra, and that's what it's about. And that's warts and all, to some extent. And the studio recordings, in order to get vocal perfection and rhythmic perfection and orchestral perfection, have forfeited that animal excitement and spontaneity.
Robert Lloyd, overcoming the limitations of the recording studio and injecting something of the spirit of a live performance into that aria from Mozart's Seraglio. How exciting a rich bass voice can be in a comic aria like that, making just as much impact as the different kinds of voices in very different kinds of music we've heard earlier. But if there's one kind of voice which people tend to think of as particularly operatic, it's this sort of voice.
Something very particular in the, let's use the word, the Italian sound, the sheer golden beauty of sound, the sunshine that's in an Italian voice.
Lord Harwood again.
And of course, that isn't always only Italians who have an Italian voice. Many non-Italians have been Italianate singers. And there is a particular kind of warm glamour that is highly acceptable when you listen to it. An Italian tenor's top C has a kind of magic that the possibly more certain, more secure top C of an Englishman, of a German, of a Frenchman doesn't have.
Luciano Pavarotti was Rodolfo in Puccini's La Bohème, pouring out his heart to his new girlfriend, reveling in the outpouring of tone, and especially in those glorious high notes. But then there can be pleasure, too, in the expression of distress. The enraged Rigoletto we heard at the beginning of the programme, calling down vengeance on his daughter's seducer, and Isolde cursing the man she feels has betrayed her, both are in the very extremity of distress. And yet there is nonetheless exhilaration, an exhilaration of anguish in the singing there of Cheryl Mills and Birgit Nilsson. A kind of enjoyment, too, in the release of feeling of whatever kind, especially in the loud high notes. According to Glenn Wilson, a psychologist with a particular interest in singers and singing, high notes generally, and not just from the tenor, are particularly well suited to getting across extremes of emotion.
The public tend to go more crazy over the higher voices than the lower voices. I guess it just does have more emotional impact. It's more like the primal scream. It's a more fundamental, primitive kind of communication. And the high points of opera, I suppose, do border on the communication that you get from a scream.
Once the voice gets very high, although they are singing in note, it is the psychological equivalent of a scream, and I'm sure it has that kind of impact on an audience when an audience feels the hair rise on the back of their spine.
Psychologist Glenn Wilson. And the high voice bordering on a scream was Maria Callas in Cavalleria Rusticana, singing there with Giuseppe Di Stefano. There's also a more purely physical or physiological reason why the operatic singing voice can have such an impact, and not just with top notes. When we're watching sport, our limbs twitch, as though we want to join in the jumping and running ourselves, and it's much the same with singing. Now, why is this? Voice teacher Esther Salomon.
I think it is because we're so involved with our own bodies, being so near to doing it ourselves and yet so far. Any other instrument is, after all, an instrument outside ourselves. We can't actually identify with a violin, however beautiful. It is a violin and we are we. But we all have that possibility of using the voice. If we're not dumb, we can all get a little bit towards what we're hearing. And so we feel tremendously physically and emotionally involved.
We've talked a great deal in this program about the problems and difficulties of singing, in particular about getting the voice over, vulnerable as it is. But the greater the problems, the greater can be the pleasure in overcoming them, in triumphing with that wonderful instrument, the human voice. If, as Esther Salomon was saying, the mere listener is involved in the process of singing, and how passionately committed to it the singer must eventually become. The late Alfred Alexander was a laryngologist who looked after many singers, and he knew as much as anyone about what it can mean to them.
It is often said that singing is an addiction. It is an addiction because what the singer wants is to relive, to re-experience that extreme happiness which he sometimes experienced when his voice radiates a wonderful feeling of fulfillment back to him. It's the highest and the greatest experience which life has to offer to them.
Alfred Alexander. But let's end with the addict himself, the singer. Robert Lloyd.
It's very much like hitting a golf ball perfectly, 300 yards. Anybody familiar with that experience will be able to remember the feeling of sheer bewilderment that the ball could go so far for so little effort, how it rises and rises in this extraordinarily beautiful arc and seems to be an eternity coming down. And the same thing happens when you hit a really beautiful phrase or a very beautiful high note when singing. It provides you with a quite disproportionate pleasure, quite disproportionate to the amount of effort that went into it. And of course, your reaction is reinforced by the reaction of the audience, who shares very often this joy. And it is really quite a, well, if you like, orgasmic experience. ¶¶